One of those admonitions that we often heard as children was don't talk to strangers. Many of us were groomed, in fact, to be wary, distrusting, and fearful, with good reason, I suppose. Still, according to Lord Jonathan Sacks, who is the former chief rabbi in the UK, the Hebrew Bible commands us only once to love thy neighbor, and commands us 36 times to love the stranger. We only have to, it seems that some kindness to strangers is a core principle in most of the world's great religions. And yet we only have to look as far as our own national conversation about immigration, or closer to home, I'm embarrassed to say, at my own behavior behind the wheel, making my daily crosstown commute, to see that we've largely tossed that one aside. While we're used to hearing the expressions a complete stranger or a total stranger, I'm struck by the equally common expression perfect stranger and by its unintended double meaning. Dozens of times in my life, I've encountered the perfect stranger, just the right person at the right moment who offers the right word, the right kindness, poses the right question, or maybe points us in a direction we never would have considered. To put that last piece in a more personal context, I need to share that I've judged myself rather harshly throughout my adult life for not having taken a more conventional, linear path to professional success. You know what I mean, college, graduate school, good job, better job, make more money, then you retire, then you die. At the same time, I've taken no small gratification and even a little pride in having chosen a more circuitous path. But I can blame a few perfect strangers for that, who have stood right in the middle of my path uninvited. One such person is a member of my home congregation in Santa Monica, Cassandra Christensen, who over 25 years ago stood in my path and held up a sign that pointed to this career of chaplaincy so many years later. Sometimes when we keep our hearts and eyes open, a stranger can show up and guide us in that direction we never would have considered. Another example came for me in 1973. I was a freshman at UCLA, majoring in design, very focused on future career success, but I also happened to really love dancing, and I was taking dance classes at the old Roland Dupre studio on La Cienega in Hollywood. I was even on scholarship, which meant I could take as many classes as I wanted for free in exchange for a few chores around the studio. That's because Roland thought he was grooming a future professional. I knew in my bones that that wasn't in the cards for me, but I went along with the program. I wanted the classes. I was a part of a small company of dancers who gave a one-night concert performance to showcase the choreography of one of the teachers at the studio, Chuck Moore. One of the other teachers at the studio, Joe Bennett, came to see that performance, was apparently impressed enough with my work that he took it upon himself to invite a friend of his, Walter Painter, a well-known choreographer at the time, to come observe me in class, because he knew Walter needed one more male dancer to fill out his chorus for a season of summer stock at the Sacramento Music Circus. Apparently, everybody in the class knew who Walter was, and they were knocking themselves out and selling it to beat the band, and there I was, clueless. But I was the one who got the note after class, please call me about work. So I called him, and he offered me the job. And my initial response was, I'm a little embarrassed to admit, Sacramento? In the summer? It's kind of hot, isn't it? What was I thinking? I was 18 years old. What better summer job could there be? And it certainly paid a hell of a lot more than selling bell bottoms at the Broadway or the May Company. So I took the job, and I had the time of my life. Worked my tail off, 5 shows in 6 weeks. You rehearse 1 show during the day, perform the other at night, no nights off. I have the fondest memories of that summer. And it actually marked the beginning of a career as a professional dancer that I said I never wanted, that ended up financing the rest of my college education. I still take dance class every Saturday from Walter some 44 years later with a bunch of old dancers. It's the highlight of my week. But I need you to hear, I didn't set my sights in that direction at all. Just like I never really set my sights on this career of chaplaincy. I felt kind of led here. So what is it that makes a stranger sometimes more perfect for us than a loved one, a friend, or a family member? For one thing, generally, a stranger generally has no agenda for us, no need to fix us or correct us or contextualize our lives for us on our behalf. more often than not, they're completely indifferent to us. And yet, in our bumping up against one another, sometimes there can be a gift, maybe a new awakening, a new awareness, revelation of a new truth, or a reminder of an old one. A few years back, I had a breast cancer patient named Dorothy, whom I would visit every week in the infusion clinic while she was getting her infusions. And her husband, Frank, came with her to every appointment. Frank was a bit of a grumpy Gus. He was kind of a curmudgeonly fellow. He was also a passionate collector and restorer of vintage cars. I listened to many stories about their cross-country trips to various car shows. One week, Frank was telling me what happened after the previous week's appointment. That week, he had chosen to drive one of his restored beauties to the appointment, and when they went back out to the parking structure after the appointment, he found the side of his car bashed in. Now, any of you that have been there, as I have, you know that deep feeling of disgust and outrage and victimhood. And he makes his way up closer to the car, and then he sees the note under the windshield wiper. Name, address, insurance information, phone number, apology. I had just been listening to Frank for weeks tell me how disenchanted he had become with the human race, and here he was given this gift. Michael, I gotta tell you, it was almost worth the hassle of having to get my car fixed just to be reminded that there's still good people out there in the world. Now, it was Frank's creative choice to find the meaning in that ordeal, but it was a stranger having done the right thing that provided the catalyst. Sometimes a stranger can be a kind of teacher. A number of years ago, late fall of 2009, my husband Scott and I took a trip to Eastern Europe, and we made a stop in Krakow, Poland, in order to visit Auschwitz in Birkenau. Those of you who have not been there, as you might imagine, it is overwhelming. It's devastating. We chose to rent a couple of those acoustic guides so we could tour the camps at our own pace rather than join a guided tour group, thinking that might dilute our experience. It was hard to know what to do with the sheer volume and intensity of emotion that would come up with each step, rounding each corner. There were so many times I wanted to say, stop, get me out of here, I can't take it, I can't breathe. But I knew I had to. I had to bear witness to every inch that I possibly could, that somehow it would be a sin not to. In the years since, there have been those who have asked, why would you ever wanted to go there, particularly as a Gentile? I mean, I understand it's a place of pilgrimage for Jews, but why was it important for you? It always struck me as an odd question. The best answer that I have is that it's important to me to try to bear witness to the absolute worst of humanity as much as I would want to bear witness to the best of it. Not only to bear witness to it, but to also own that those aspects of humanity are alive within me too. Cruelty, hatred, anger, indifference. I try to embrace the notion that nothing human is foreign to me. It always seemed a little glib to write off the Holocaust as some kind of aberration committed by subhuman evil monsters. Thank goodness I'm not like that, huh? It was unseasonably cold for late October, bitterly cold, in fact. As I walked the camps, I found myself wondering about the more peripheral workers at the camps and wondering what that must have been like. They certainly must have witnessed the most horrific scenes day in and day out and presumably went home at the end of the day to families. Hi, hon, I'm home. How was your day? How is that possible? Is it humanly possible to compartmentalize to that degree? Just then, this sweet little stray cat rubbed up against my ankle. He was purring his head off, weaving his way in and around my feet, and I squatted down to pick him up to give him some love. Come here, sugar. Trying to squeeze myself into this teeny bubble of sweetness and affection, desperately, urgently wanting a reprieve from all of this horror, even for a moment. And in an instant, feeling so guilty for wanting that reprieve and for taking it. And in the same instant, I realized I had my answer. That's how it's done. You simply move into another bubble of reality. That cat was my teacher. That cat was a perfect stranger. Not long ago, a colleague of mine asked me to go see Bruce in the hospital, who was dying of end-stage liver cancer. I only met Bruce the one time, and only saw him through this narrow window of critical illness at the end of his life. Still, such a narrow opening can offer a surprisingly intimate view, particularly to the stranger. Bruce is one who had lived his life on a very big stage, one of corporate boardrooms and international travel. His world had now shrunk down to the size of this hospital room. Not having many friends or family about locally, his society had been distilled down to the doctors and nurses and the housekeeping staff that came in to clean his room. Life had changed. The world had changed. It seemed Bruce was at a kind of spiritual crossroads. He shared with me that he wanted to connect with the Methodist faith he dimly remembered from his youth but didn't know how. He wanted to pray but didn't know how or for what. So rather than launch into some lofty theological discussion, we started closer in. And I asked Bruce to reflect on the magic inherent in small gestures of kindness. Tender mercies, if you will. Oh, I know exactly what you mean, Michael. Just last night, I had the most wonderful conversation with the woman who came in to clean my room. Now, if you met Bruce, you would never peg him to be the one having conversations with the housekeeping staff. But as I say, life had changed. The world had changed. She was it in that moment. She had such a sweet smile, and she was so warm and kind that she just made me feel like it was okay. She even gave me a little gift. His eyes filled with tears as he pointed to the little plastic angel over there on the shelf. I knew he had been touched by the magic of just being seen, of being witnessed, of connecting. I, for one, put my faith in those kinds of connections, in that kind of connectedness, often between strangers. A few years ago, I was invited to speak at the cancer support community out in Westlake, Calabasas area, to an audience of primarily cancer patients. And after my talk, there was a time for Q&A. And a woman raises her hand and asks me what I think is the meaning of life. Oh, that. While I'm trying to come up with something to say that sounds reasonably intelligent, she doesn't wait for my answer. She wants to tell me hers, which is as it should be. And she said, well, I think the meaning of life is that everybody wants to be seen, known, received. I remember at the time my judging mind going into overdrive thinking, well, that's very sweet, dear, but it's kind of simplistic. Thank you for sharing. Next question. But I'll tell you, I've quoted her countless times in the years since, because I think she came close to hitting it right on the head. Too many times I've experienced it. I've witnessed it myself with patients. The magic in just being seen, received, accepted in my life, in this circumstance, as I am in it right now. Just last year, I went to fill up my car at the local gas station, the USA station that has the cheapest prices in the neighborhood. That afternoon, the place was packed, and I had to wait for a pump, and I pulled up and I pumped my gas, and it comes time to back away from the pump, and I'm checking my side view mirrors and my rear view mirror and my rear view camera, and then I hear crunch. I'd hit one of those 3-foot-tall posts filled with concrete that was there to protect the apparently very fragile concrete curb surrounding the gas station sign. It was the one spot that was out of view of all my mirrors and camera. I didn't know it in that moment, but it was a $1,500 mistake. Anybody who knows me knows that such a mistake is proof in my mind that I don't deserve to live. I wish I were kidding. I got out of the car to inspect the damage, and I hit it in just the right way that the rear bumper, the rear quarter panel, the hatch cover, and the taillight were all damaged. The taillight lay there on the concrete like some wounded animal. I sat there staring in shock at this catastrophe, contemplating my own suicide, and I was unaware of the man in front of me who was pumping gas and had seen the whole thing. Big strapping fellow, you would never cast to be the merciful angel in this moment. He walked over to me and just said, oh man, that's rough, dude. I'm sorry. Said with all the compassion he could muster. Not knowing what else to do, he bends over to pick up my taillight and he tenderly hands it to me as if it is my wounded dog. And I take the taillight and I put it in the trash can. And there's a part of me observing the whole scene back here that sees the preposterousness of it all and even sees the dark humor in it, but I'm way too lost in my own grief and self-reproach, but also gratitude for him. I knew in that moment that he softened the blow for me by just seeing it. He got it. He knew how much it hurt. I could not thank him enough for his kindness. In our 39 years together, Scott and I have always had cats. And in December of 01, our boy Junior died. There has never been one before or since quite like Junior Junebug. It was a Friday, and he was at home, and I was at home. Scott was en route coming home from New York on a business trip. And I decided to stay home and wait with Junior with his body, thinking Scott might want to see him to say goodbye before we took him in to get cremated. Scott's plane landed early in the afternoon, and he called me from the cab, and I said, "Junior's gone." And I asked him if he wanted me to wait. And he said, "No, please, I can't see him like that. Will you please take him in?" So I wrapped him in a little towel, and I put him in the car, and I drove over to the vet. And I didn't want to drag his stiff little body in through the waiting room where everybody's got their dogs and cats, so I left him in the car. And I went up to the front desk, and I choked it out. "My boy's gone. Will somebody please come out to the car and get him for me?" I went back out to the car, and I'm holding Junior for the last time, and out walks this little Latino vet's assistant, and when he sees me, his shoulders just go like that. He just saw me. He didn't need to say anything. He got it. And I kissed Junior for the last time, and I handed him over, and I got back in my car, and I just sobbed. And I was unaware of the two people that had seen the whole transaction that were picking up their German Shepherd, and they walked over to my window and knocked on the window. And I rolled it down, and they just said, "Can we drive you home?" I didn't accept their offer, but those five words changed my life. They imprinted my heart with an image of what it means to be seen, what it means to be kind. What is it that keeps us from being that perfect stranger, from being the one who's willing to step out and say, "I see you, I'll be your witness. I'll face my own powerlessness, knowing there's nothing I can do to make it better. Nothing but be here and be kind." I do think that's it in large measure. It's not an easy thing to come next to another in their suffering, sit right down next to them, knowing there's nothing you can do to make it better. Nothing but be there, be a witness. A year or so ago, I was speaking to another congregation, and a man came up to me afterward and asked, "How is it possible for you to create these meaningful relationships with your patients? It must take a long time to build that kind of trust," he said. I thought for a moment, you know what? It really takes no time at all. Hearts are already broken wide open. The stakes are too high. It just doesn't make any sense to stand on formality and ceremony. Much in the same way, one might have a very meaningful, even intimate conversation with a total stranger one meets while traveling, particularly to a very faraway place. There you both are, away from home, vulnerable, foreign territory. Just doesn't make any sense to stand behind the facades we use at home to stand behind. About a year ago, a friend of mine lost his elderly mother, and I called him the day after she died just to check in and say, "How you doing today?" And he said, "The crazy thing is that my partner, my friends, everybody keeps waiting for me to fall apart, and I just don't. But I'm finding it's strangers who get past my defenses in a way that those closest to me just cannot." A number of years ago, I had a patient, Randy, maybe early 50s, stage 4 colon cancer. I had so many wonderful conversations with Randy before he died. Not long before he died, I was walking him out of the clinic, and we're out in the hallway still chatting, and up walks another patient making her way to the entrance of the clinic. Gingerly, she's on a walker. Randy says, "Excuse me, just a minute, Michael." And he goes over and he just holds the door for her with a big smile. "There you go." He comes back to me. He says, "You see, Michael, the way I see it, that's my job now, to be kind. Randy is one who had lived a high-power professional life in commercial real estate. His professional life had been distilled down to that as one who gives kindness. Cancer had already taken so much from him, but it didn't rob him of that career opportunity. It didn't rob him of that place to still find meaning in his life. Many years ago, I saw an interview on TV between Bill Moyers and Pema Chodron, the well-known Buddhist teacher and author. And they were talking about New York after 9/11. And Bill was commenting on how after 9/11, that New Yorkers weren't behaving like New Yorkers anymore. That they were kind of watching out for each other and being kind and going that extra distance. And yet slowly, as life got back to normal, they started behaving like New Yorkers again. As an explanation, Pema offered, that's because after 9/11, New Yorkers really understood the groundless nature of life, the impermanence of it, that there is nothing to hold on to but this moment. And when we really get it, the groundlessness of life, the only response that makes any sense at all is kindness to others and to ourselves. It is so deceptively simple. It's such a wildly undervalued virtue, kindness. And yet, I believe it offers us the pathway to being that perfect stranger. And in recognizing and feeling gratitude for all those countless gestures of kindness shown to us, we get to experience the magic of so many perfect strangers in our midst, particularly those who might be willing to drive us all the way home. So be it. Thank you.